Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. This week's selections include special lockbox panels. The lockbox is open, so show your support by donating and helping WAMC deliver the information you need. You can pledge anytime online at WAMC.org. On Wednesday, September 25th, the special lockbox panel focused on economics, and Joe was joined by Professor of Economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti. American economist working as Professor of Economics at Bard College, is president of the Levi Economics Institute, and an expert at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Pavlina Chernova, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
All right, so let's start with kind of a general, I guess, mission statement or opening statement from each of our panelists this morning on where we are with the economy, the major issues facing the economy, and most importantly, I guess, and I'll put it this way in my question, is what should it mean for voters? We are told that the economy seems to be the number one issue facing voters this election season, that according to the rash of polls that are coming up in the lead up to the presidential election. So what does that mean? And ultimately, what are those challenges facing the economy? Aaron.
Well, that's a giant question that we could spend the entire 90 minutes on. But won't. The biggest issue, I think there's two issues. There's the immediate issue that is on every voter's mind, which is inflation and the run-up of that in following the pandemic and the recent deceleration. But I think a sub-story and a bigger part of that has been the 40-plus year rise in income inequality and declining opportunity for well over half of the population, that there have been trends like deindustrialization, the decline of the union movement, globalization, financialization, automation, the rise of big firms and increasing market concentration that has just continued to push the average, I mean, it's not even middle class work, you're working your way up to the upper middle class as well, push these people closer to the edge of a cliff. And I think over the past, particularly since the financial crisis, a lot of the population is really at the edge of the cliff. So because of that, they feel like the current, two-party system and traditional policies have abandoned them, and they've turned to less traditional candidates and less traditional ideas. And I think you see that with both of the candidates' platforms. So, to me, it's the rise in inequality and the associated lack of opportunity and increased insecurity and financial pressures that people feel. To me, that's what's driving a lot of modern economic dynamics and a lot of political dynamics as well.
Pavlina.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think we should start off by also acknowledging that this was the fastest recovery that we have ever experienced in post-war period. So I think we want to start with a little bit of good news because, you know, over the last 50, 60 years, we have slogged through jobless recoveries. You know, we had recession after recession, protracted, you know, jobless growth, a lot of economic pain, and that has created these structural problems that Aaron is talking about. And now we face this, you know, enormous crisis, double-digit unemployment that we hadn't seen for such a long time, and we recovered very quickly. So we should acknowledge that we have tools to turn things around. And yet, we really haven't addressed these underlying structural issues. So I think when people complain about the economy, until recently they were complaining about their own personal situation. You know, they're complaining about gas prices, food prices. They're complaining about rent, unaffordability of housing, debt, health care, school loans, all of that. But now, increasingly, jobs are taking center stage. The Conference Board Sentiment Survey came out yesterday, and Households are losing faith in their ability to find jobs. I mean, that is also consistent with some of the slowdown we're seeing in the job market. And when jobs take center stage, that speaks to this fundamental economic insecurity. So I think I agree with Aaron. You know, we're talking about problems of mobility. Do people feel that relative to their parents, they're advancing and that their children relative to them will do better? Is their standard of living going to increase? Do they feel their jobs are stable enough? What if the next recession is around the corner? Can they weather it? And yeah, I mean, this massive inequality that has absolutely accelerated, that has created the haves and have-nots. So I would summarize it as economic security in these multiple dimensions, jobs, housing, mobility. But we got to add the climate crisis as well, because that is, you know, in some areas of the country, that is a very obvious devastation to livelihood. And in other areas, it's a quiet impact on our ability to go about our daily lives. Floods, right? Storms, power outages, that we got to put that on the table as well.
Mark Whitman.
My comments are largely in line with the two economists. I'm going to try and behave today since I am outnumbered, Joe. I agree.
Oh, don't behave.
I think affordability is a big issue.
We're trying to make money.
Well, I think affordability is a big issue. If you look at housing, childcare, medical costs, and education, those are the big ones that remain, even if people eventually get used to, say, grocery prices where they are now. And I think behind affordability, particularly with housing and a little bit with medical care, there's an issue with respect to the costs associated with the climate change. You're going to see it. So you're also going to see it in auto insurance as well, to some extent, but the insurance costs around housing are going to become an ever larger burden, particularly for people who can least afford it. And that's something, by the way, I don't think the current candidates are dealing with. Globalization has exacerbated on some local basis is inequality and security. What Western economies got right was that global trade was better for the economy. What they got wrong was that in very localized geographies, it actually diminished the equality, increased insecurity, and decreased people's view of perceived opportunity. And the economic policies, if we're going to combat this rising populism, have to ameliorate those issues on a local basis. And finally, I'd say that there is still a transition going on in our economy. We are near-shoring and friend-shoring production for a couple of reasons, one of which was we learned a lot through COVID. And secondly, China is now potentially the next Russia, who may well be on the other side of a wall with whom we can't trade. And acknowledging that, and that feeds back into inflation rates, which are never going to get to the Fed's 2% target over a protracted period of time. The sad thing, Joe, if you think about what all three of us just enumerated as the problems facing the American economy, you have two proposals from the candidates I would call Donald Trump's sort of, you know, dangerous snake oil. You're better if you don't take it than if you do. And then you have Kamala Harris's. Her slogan should be, my economic policy is not as bad as the other guys. Unfortunately, neither of them really address the fundamental problems, in my view, that we've discussed.
So you've teed up the golf ball perfectly for me to ask the question that I wanted to ask. I actually had two, but I'm going to kind of morph them together because of the way that you set it up. With the candidate platforms, Aaron, you mentioned this, the candidate platforms of people looking at those, and just that general question of how clear are they, and do they help people understand exactly what they're in for? Also, with that, Pavelina, you were talking about people taking stock and looking at different things and seeing where they fit in this. Do they actually do that? Or is it more innate? Is it more deep within them that I don't want to say it's a knee-jerk reaction because that means it's not thoughtful, but even a thoughtful reaction to, okay, so this bill came in yesterday, so I'm not going to buy this like I thought I was going to.
Yeah, I think, you know, people don't sit and think about the economy. They sit and think about their families.
I know you wish they did.
I wish they did, but there's this disconnect because economists will say, well, how come people don't get it that, you know, the economy is as good as it's been in the last 50 years? And, you know, we've had such a strong growth, which I also wanted to stress, but only for the purposes of saying, look, we've got tools. There are ways to turn around this ship. But the average household doesn't sit around the dinner table and talk about, well, look at this great recovery. They're looking and they're saying, well, can we send the kids to school? And, oh, gosh, you know, my credit card interest rate payments just shot up. And what am I going to cut back on? And so over a long period of time, people have started to see things slip away from them. The access to decent housing, the access to affordable education, healthcare costs, you know, are very high. And so this is kind of the quiet pain, I would say, that people are feeling. So we need to figure out an economy that, yes, the slogan is great, opportunity economy. There are, in my view, good pieces in there. But we need to be thinking about how to lift up the middle class. I like this, you know, framing at the local level to really recognize that there are regional, there are pockets across the country where this recovery is not felt. You know, there are pockets in this country where unemployment rates are double what the national unemployment rate, triple, you know, what the national unemployment rate. And so think about these aspects of economic insecurity that can change folks' lives.
It is... this is a very cynical question. I apologize. In other words, we have the tools to, are we correcting it or are we making it look like it's corrected?
Are we correcting the economy? You mean
yes,
the path?
Yes, I mean aspect. Yeah. I mean, when you look and you say, like, we have the tools to correct this.
Yeah.
Like, are we correcting it or are we making it a perception that certain aspects of the economy are much stronger than perhaps they really are?
Well, let me just maybe add some specifics. During COVID, we provided universal child allowance. We halved child poverty in a year. I mean, quite unprecedented. Clearly, we can do that. We don't need calamity to wipe out child poverty. During COVID, we expanded medical coverage. So folks understood, oh, hey, actually, the government can give access to affordable health care.
Right.
During COVID, we did put some brakes on debt payments. So, yes, the government has tool to deal with the whether it's student loan debts, other kind of debt forgiveness programs. So I think people understood that it is possible to have some meaningful policies to make their lives better. And this was in the middle of a very difficult situation. So when you look ahead, I think we could look to that particular crisis period and say, what can we do about debt restructuring? What could we do about child poverty? What could we do about affordable housing, et cetera? These are the kinds of tools that I'm talking about.
And then they took it away.
And then they took it away, and exactly. And then we wonder why people are not happy.
Right, and then you go back to the problem you had before, right? And that's sort of the cyclical nature of this, Aaron.
Yeah, the pandemic kind of reminds me of World War II in terms of economic policy. It was a catastrophic event that really upended our way of living. And the lessons we took from World War II was that, well, if the government wants to steer and manage the economy through the use of, you know, government spending and tax policy, what economists call fiscal policy, they could do that. And granted, they stopped short of some of the broader goals, things like guaranteed employment in 1946. But in terms of like Eisenhower's Interstate Highway System Act, the massive investment in infrastructure, the massive investment in human resources like the Great Society programs, the GI Bill, all of those made it very clear and provided, you know, with massive amounts of government spending and high taxes on upper income earners, opportunity for people to improve their lot. With COVID, we, as Pavlina mentioned, we saw a modern dabbling of that with some debt restructuring, child care, income support, and so on. But it was temporary. And then as soon as the CARES Act expired and Biden's American rescue plan expired, it was back to normal. People are having difficulty making payments. That also coincided with the rise in inflation. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch of all of that money that we have been giving you is now not coming anymore, and you're back to the hardships you faced before, in addition to a lot of the inflation that went up. So the tools are there, and this could have been a teachable moment and a learning moment for the country, but it seems, and then, you know, again, it's not an accident that we lost that train of thought. It was because a lot of politicians were trying to steer us away from that line of thinking.
Mark.
Joe, as we turn our lens from the question of how's the economy doing to how's the economy doing and what can we do politically to help it, or at least not get in its way, I think it's worth noting, just starting out, that if you were an alien looking down at this world, and you realized that there was a particular nation that had less than 5% of the population and accounted for in excess of 1/5 of the economic output, you would say, well, those people should complain about nothing. They have the capability in terms of the resources at their disposal to fix their problems if they have any. And the answer is we do, but it is not unlimited, and that's where we start to deal in politics. The one issue that I didn't bring up in my opening was that we do have now an enormous deficit as a country, and we have a structural deficit. We have taken it for granted, and unfortunately, these two candidates are effectively taking it for granted that we can keep spending beyond our means indefinitely. And there is no historical precedent for that in the world. As a matter of fact, there's lots of reasons to believe that that leads to terrible things. So the one pressing issue that both candidates have decided to ignore because it's unpopular is the fact that we have to rearrange what we're doing within sort of what the government's spending now and actually reduce what the government's spending, as opposed to turning to as opposed to dramatically increasing what the government's spending without taking in appropriate taxes. The other thing I'd say is, if you look at the affordability crisis, housing, education, childcare, these are I think economists call them, can be solved by on the supply side, which is if we build more houses, presumably the cost of housing will come down over time. And if you look, for instance, at what the candidates are doing on many of these questions, is they're trying to fix these issues with a demand side solution, i.e., I'm going to give everybody who's in the supermarket trying to buy bananas today an extra $5. Well, guess what happens? If there are no bananas that day, the price of bananas just goes up. So a lot of the policies that the candidates are proposing on both sides, frankly, sort of ignore some of the basic gravity that works on our economy. We are an enormous example of human success as a country economically. If you look historically, there is no precedent. We can fix these problems. Unfortunately, in order to do that, we have to make trade-offs, and neither of our political candidates have really started to ask the country what trade-offs matter.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 25th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 26, a Lockbox panel focused on Iran, and Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, 15 years of reporting experience across the globe with the focus on Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan, is a qualitative researcher, PhD candidate, and a graduate teaching assistant in the Department of Communication at Wayne State University, Fariba Pajou, and Crisis Group's Iran Project Director and Senior Advisor to the President, adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, and a fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, is a co-author of How Sanctions Work, Iran and the Impact of Economic Warfare, Ali Vize.
Let us begin the conversation, and Fariba, I'll start off with you, of why you believe conversations like this are important in the sense of making people aware of Iran and the issues, and especially in an election year, for them to understand the importance of Iran and the importance of our relationship with Iran.
Good morning, everyone. And I think, well, it's the story between Iran and the U.S. is a longer story in terms of conflict. So, and most of the president in the Iran and the government in Iran and the U.S. were talking about each other. So I think that's, first of all, it's important itself. But I want to talk about Iranian people. Of course, I am not a spokesperson for like the diverse community of Iranian people, like inside Iran. But at least I can talk about based on my life experience and like my observation. And also, well, still I am in touch with a lot of people, my family and friends back home. So I think, so I'm talking from that angle, from like Iranian people, specifically youth in Iran. I think most Iranian, especially the younger generation, see peace and positive relationship with the global community, specifically actually the U.S. If I want to bring out like tangible example for that, the best and the most telling example of understanding the mindset and desire of the youth is the Grammy Award that Shervin Hajipour, a younger Iranian songwriter and composer, and actually he is a pop star now, won in 2023 for his global hit "4" or in Farsi "Baraye" in the category of best for social change. In his song, Shervin captured the heart of Iranian youth, expressing their yearning for a normal life in a normal country with normal relationship with the world, including the U.S. And the song became a global sensation, resonating not only within Iran, but across the world. If I may bring up a very short example again about like Iranian people and how they are, just like fighting back or like looking to the world and standing. I want to address the situation of women in Iran, focusing on the courageous efforts of many young people who have opposed government imposed rules, particularly after the tragic and brutal death of Mahsa Amini. These protests challenged the regulation enforced by the morality police and hardliners inside Iran, including the strict dress code laws. I think these are, I mean, these two could be a very good sign to show how Iranian people actually are thinking about the war and also about the U.S. and the relationship with the U.S.
Ali Vize.
Well, I think Vamede made a lot of really good points. Let me look at it from another angle, which is why is that this country is important for the United States and how it impacts our lives here. You know, it's essential to understand that this is a country that has 7,000 years of history, 3,000 years of state history. They had government 3,000 years ago. It's a new, not a new kid on the block, but it has been around for a long time. And it has always been this bellwether state that has been the udder of the West, whether it was the Romans or the Greeks or the Ottomans and so on. And we still have issues with Iran around the same areas that they have historically been problematic, the Levant, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and so on. Now, this is a country that has a lot of Americans have bad memories from in 1979 with the U.S. Embassy hostage crisis. But it has been a country that has also been more targeted by U.S. sanctions than almost any other state. Even Russia today is not under as many secondary U.S. sanctions than Iran is. It's a country that has its finger in every problem that the United States has in that part of the world, whether it's in Yemen, where Iran supports the Houthi militias, or it's Iraq, where hundreds of Americans were killed during the U.S. occupation of Iraq, or Syria, where now you see increased tensions with Israel, as well as in Lebanon, where you have the crown jewel of Iran's network of partners and proxies in the region, which is Hezbollah. And, of course, Hamas, who started that horrible war with Israel on October 7th, has been supported and funded and trained by Iran for a very long time. In addition to that, we have now seen, even in this presidential campaign, Iranian attempts to assassinate former President Trump, who, ordered the killing of Iranian General Soleimani in 2020. And as a result of it, Iran has been seeking retaliation and revenge against anybody who was involved in the planning execution of that assassination. And we've also had, for similar reasons, Iran hacking former President Trump's campaign and sharing some of the documents they obtained with the Biden campaign and also with the press. And Iran is also, very close now to the ability to develop nuclear weapons. And, of course, that would make all of these problematic issues that I talked about, in addition to internal issues, especially human rights-related concerns that Fariba mentioned, that's much more difficult to deal with.
It seems as though, and we have this conversation on many different issues, not just Iran, but when it comes to former President Trump and what he says and the outrageous nature of it sometimes. Yesterday, Donald Trump suggested without evidence that Iran might have been involved in two recent attempted assassinations against him, as he called for threatening to blow the country to smithereens if it harmed a presidential candidate. This was during campaign remarks in North Carolina. I'm curious, Ali, as we look at this, of how that obviously is soaked in and lands in the United States for voters, but more importantly to the purposes of our conversation, of how it is received in Iran and especially with the government of Iran.
Right. So, the reality is that President Trump in his first term in office came pretty close to the verge of confrontation with Iran, military confrontation, and he hesitated and did not pull the trigger. Once, this was in June of 2019, when Iran shot down a U.S. drone. And according to President Trump, we came to almost 10 minutes from bombing Iran. And he decided that there will be too many collateral damage on the ground, and he decided not to do it. Then again in September of that year, when Iran was involved in an attack against Saudi oil facilities in retaliation for the U.S. cutting off Iranian oil exports, Trump considered but decided not to take military action against Iran. And finally, in January 2020, after he killed Soleimani, Iran retaliated by the biggest volley of ballistic missiles that were fired into U.S. bases in Iraq, and there were more than 100 traumatic brain injuries that the U.S. forces suffered there, and yet Trump decided not to take action. So it's good to you know, try to speak in a threatening way. But the reality is that President Trump has proven time and time again that he doesn't want to engage in another disastrous war in the Middle East. He's very reluctant to do so. And in fact, he takes credit for the fact that he's one of the only American presidents who did not start a new war. And so Iranians know this. And, you know, there is a presidential executive order in this country that bans assassinating other foreign leaders. And that's for a reason. The reason is that it would then basically make it make retaliation in kind quite likely. And that would become a major problem. And so it was the reckless and misguided decision to go down this road for President Trump that has now created all of these consequences. The killing of Soleimani did not change anything. Iranian Revolutionary Guards is more powerful than ever, is projecting power in the region, as you see, from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea to even the Indian Ocean. And Soleimani's replacement has been able to pick up from where he left off. And so all of this cost for a very intangible gain. And, you know, the threats of pulverizing, again, an ancient nation state, of course, I understand where it comes from, because President Trump obviously primarily cares about his own life. But doesn't necessarily make him endears him in the eyes of the Iranian people. A lot of whom seen him as a good choice because they think he would be tougher with the Islamic Republic. But you know, I think it basically undermines U.S.'s soft power and doesn't necessarily deter the Iranians because they think at the end of the day, Trump doesn't have what it takes to start a new war in the Middle East. And the last point I make is that, you know, reality is that President Trump in his first term and also in some of his remarks during this campaign has said that he doesn't really care about democracy in Iran or you know, the well-being of the Iranian people. All he wants is the allure of outwitting the cunning Iranians at the negotiating table. These are, again, people who've been merchants for thousands of years, and he believes that if he can outsmart them at the negotiating table, it will be the ultimate proof of his skills of the art of the deal. And that's what he's primarily interested in, not necessarily bombing Iran.
Fariba, I'm interested in your thoughts as well of things that Trump said yesterday and the overall this idea of if Iran is involved, and especially with the assassination attempts, of his words blowing them to smithereens and the thoughts on that. We have about 2 minutes or so.
I'm not sure how to talk about Trump conversation, because it's very difficult actually for me to make some kind of connection with what he is saying. Yeah, yesterday he mentioned that we have to attack Iran and destroy all the big cities in Iran. I'm like, okay, as Ali well said, it is kind of, I'm not sure then how he were talking about that. I don't want to start any war. And then now he is obviously saying that if I was the president, I would destroy the big cities. I'm not sure. Like, I cannot talk exactly about Trump because logically, I cannot make any connection with what he is saying in his speech and his remarks. That's why I want to talk about one of his decisions that kind of affected a lot of Iranian people. That it's about he withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. I'm not sure how many minutes more we have time, but I would like to talk about that.
Yes, I do want to talk about that. The U.S.'s withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The U.S. announced its withdrawal also known as the Iran nuclear deal or the Iran deal, on May 8th, 2018. And Fariba, what do you see the importance and repercussions of that decision being?
In this specific case, I really want to talk about what exactly the sanctions affected my personal life and my family life. At first, I want to say the sanctions primarily affect ordinary Iranian citizens, while some government officials have the means to circumvent them. They are doing that, and some of them are making a lot of money out of it, and they are doing that regularly. So in 2018, I wrote a piece called New U.S. Sanctions Will Make Iranian Seeker, which reflects how the sanctions affected my personal and my family life. Well, sanctions against Iran are almost as old as I am. I'm not that old, though. I was born in early 1980, and international sanctions against Iran began during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, as most global and regional powers supported Iraqi President Saddam Hussein in his invasion on Iran. My father was injured and exposed to chemical weapons during that war, and as a result, he suffered from Parkinson's later in his life. I remember in 2012, as I said, it's a very personal story. In 2012, it became deeply difficult for Iranians to access medicine for rare and chronic illnesses because of the extensive sanctions against Iran. I have to mention that although sanctions over Tehran's nuclear program didn't directly target medicine or hospitals, they did restrict banking and trade, which limited financing for imports of medicine and led to limited medical supplies, making the life difficult for people. Anyway, I clearly remember that sad summer that evening after work, I went to a special pharmacy in Tehran, and it was 100 degrees that day, and I was staying like 45 minutes in a line, and I went in, and the pharmacist told me that, oh, sorry, we don't have it. And I was like, okay, what do I have to do? And then he was like, you might be able to find it in black market. And I was like, black market? You know, how you can trust the black market, medicine, if they are safe or real. Anyway, for 3 months, my father used the Iranian brand, and his health got much worse. He never recovered from that, and I lost my beloved father when he was only 63 in 2016. This is my message, and I want to emphasize that after saying to you, this is my very personal story. Sanctions are against the Iranian people much more than the Iranian government, period.
That was Fariba Pajou on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 26. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, September 27th, Joe Donahue was out and Sarah LeDuc hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Senior Fellow Bard Center for Civic Engagement Jim Ketterer, and investment banker on Wall Street Mark Whitman.
Let's go first to New York City. The mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, has been charged with accepting bribes and illegal campaign contributions from foreign sources after an indictment was filed against the leader of one of the world's biggest cities. This is from The Guardian. In a 5-count criminal indictment, prosecutors allege that before and during his terms as mayor, Adams, quote, sought and accepted improper valuable benefits, such as luxury international travel, including from wealthy foreign business people, and at least one Turkish government official seeking to gain influence over him, end quote. The criminal counts against Adams include conspiracy to commit wire fraud and to receive campaign contributions by foreign nationals, wire fraud and solicitation of a contribution by a foreign national. Adams' arraignment is scheduled for noon today before Magistrate Judge Catherine Parker. The complaint focuses on trips Adams and his partner took to Turkey, India, and Ghana on Turkish Airlines, sometimes staying in luxury hotels that, as an elected official, he should have disclosed to the government and campaign contributors made by Turkish officials through a system of straw donors. The indictment notes that at the time when Turkey allegedly called up those debts, there was a building close to the UN that would have failed a fire department of New York inspection, and Turkey insisted that Adams pressure the FDNY to approve construction and opening of that building. Shortly before prosecutors held a press conference yesterday to announce the charges, Adams held his own, surrounded by clergy and family, as well as protesters calling for his resignation. The mayor insists that he's innocent and says he will not resign. Jim.
Yeah, well,
a lot to this.
Yeah, there is a lot to this.
I didn't get to all of it, of course.
I think there's so much to unpack on this, and it's interesting on so many different levels. I mean, it's New York City is a city, so there's the locality of running the city. It's also part of New York State, which many people around the world always kind of forget about.
Yeah,
and there's interesting things I think we can explore about the relationship between the state and the city, in particular the governor and the mayor at this point. But it's also it's a global city. And so if it were a country, it would be a major player as a country, both in its just its size, its economic heft, and its importance globally. So somebody who is the mayor of New York City is always going to be on the global, the local, and the state stage, and a ripe target for those who would like to influence that person, influence them in a way that leads to transactions. I mean, particularly foreign governments, you know, are not giving over this money. And this particular amount of money wasn't a huge amount, but anybody who's ever taken a long-haul international flight knows that you, if you're in coach, you really want to be in business or first class. So the amount of money might not be a lot, but clearly the transactional nature of this is important. I've lived in places around the world where there is such corruption around the building of buildings, the inspection of buildings, and there are real consequences to this as well. They do catch on fire and people die if the fire systems are not proper. They do collapse if the building codes are not followed. So to have this happen in New York City it's not the first time that it's happened, but to have the mayor indicted, this is the first time. The governor has the power to remove the mayor if she wants to. She put out a statement that hedged on what should happen, and I think she's waiting. A lot of people are waiting to see what is going to transpire over the next few days. I also saw that Al Sharpton came out and said, what would be the effects of Adams staying in office, trying to vigorously defend himself, and would that affect the Harris-Waltz campaign? Would there be any blowback on that? And he's convening meetings and meeting with leaders. So I'm sure that the pressure will continue on Adams to resign. The pressure will continue on Governor Hochul to remove him from office. And the last thing I would say about this is that, you know, I think this is really just one more story of a much bigger story of foreign money influencing people like now a convicted former Senator Bob Menendez, the $10 million that was alleged to have gone to Trump from the Egyptian government. There's a lot of foreign money that washes around our think tanks and research institutes, and it's all with a purpose. And it just seems like they're finding fertile ground to peddle influence, and they're finding enough people to take it at, in some cases, a relatively low cost. But once you've got somebody on the hook, once they've gone bad and they're taking your money, you can ask them to do all sorts of things.
The email address to join the conversation this morning is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Teresa.
I innocent until proven guilty. Obviously, I think one of the challenges is it appears to reach so deep into his administration that the question of whether or not he stays and goes is not just about him. It's about a broad swath of his key people in his administration. So I think that ups the ante about how stable his administration would be. And they appear to literally have the receipts and the recordings and other things. But again, innocent till proven guilty. And I think that, the key question over the next couple of days is, does he resign? I can't imagine the governor removing him, but we don't know all the facts yet. I think that's pretty complicated. If he does resign, there is a process. It's the public advocate becomes the mayor until there's a special election. That's Jermoni Williams. So, it's clear what the path is, at least in the short term, for transfer of leadership. I don't think he has any particularly close relationship to Vice President Harris, so I'm not sure what the intersection with the campaign is. In terms of getting the vote out or anything like that. But I was interested in you mentioning the $10 million to Trump. Because, I don't say this as a way to say it's not a small thing. I think it is a big thing. But as you, I think, very insightfully pointed out, and this is what I was thinking last night, is this range of situations we've seen about foreign influence and foreign money. I also saw yesterday in the New York Times, and I don't think this has gotten much attention, but Jared Kushner's fund has reached millions of dollars in fees and returned no profit so far. This is out of a report that came out from the Senate Finance Committee. They have done an inquiry, and as people may recall, in 2021, he got money from Saudi Arabia and other foreign investors, and he has, according to this report, he has reaped about $112 million in fees so far with no payouts. And it raises a lot of questions about what really is that money. And I think maybe if you could speak more to the $10 million that Trump got. It says Menendez. What's the overall implication of the range of all of this?
I just want to say one further thing about that $10 million and Trump. Part of that story was that Bill Barr allegedly quashed the case and told the Justice Department not to pursue it. And I think in normal circumstances, you would see members of Congress saying, okay, let's get Barr under oath. Let's have a public hearing and have him answer some tough questions. But what we can see from this, the range of cases we see already with influence peddling, this is a bipartisan affair. And I think many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, unfortunately, are reluctant to hold people's feet to the fire because this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's more going on. Even just with the Egypt money, people don't want to rock the boat on Egypt because Democrats and Republicans, members of Congress across the country, benefit from that Egypt relationship because there's huge amounts, billions of dollars that are spent on defense contractors that are spread across the country, including in our listening area. And so we haven't heard anything about that really since the Washington Post broke that story. And that is telling, that the silence is telling.
Right. That's been stunning to me that so little attention has been given to that $10 million. It just seemed, and to the Jared Kushner, as soon as he leaves the White House.
Jared Kushner, the potential future Secretary of State of the country.
Right. And as the Senator Wyden pointed out in this study, this report that came out, he's the committee chairman, that he create, that they're looking at the potential conflicts of interest that this creates, particularly with his father-in-law, running for president. But I also worry, and this is Pollyannish of me, but I also worry about this constant sense that all politicians are corrupt and that you can't trust anybody in government. And, you know, I think that that's not the case, but you, what gets the focus is those who are, and what doesn't get the focus is those who aren't, you know, and because they're going about their day-to-day business. But I think it just chips away at the confidence of our, in our government, which I think is really unfortunate.
Mark Whitman.
Well, first of all, I do think there's a important intersection with national politics. And if you missed it, Trump himself said that he thought, I don't know if he said he's claiming he said or he thought that I knew that when Adams stood up to Biden, the Biden administration with respect to immigration and the influx of immigrants into New York, I knew they'd indict him.
But that was a ridiculous statement.
I understand it's a ridiculous statement, but you know what? It underscores the but Adams himself has asserted that the reason he's in trouble is because now I agree with you're innocent until proven guilty. But let me tell you, I think that intersection makes it profoundly disappointing that so many politicians in New York have failed to show leadership and spine. I mean, I'll give it to AOC. She came out right away and said the guy should resign. Our paint-by-numbers governor infuriates me. I understand the guy's innocent, but he's charged with serious crimes that affect, and there's so much smoke and fire already around his administration. She should have come out yesterday and said, I'll make this easy for Mayor Adams. If he doesn't resign, I will remove him. She needs to show some political background. And so too, you know, Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, and Gillibrand all came out with wishy-washy statements that were just stomach-churning when you hear them, frankly. The other thing I want to point out is I read sort of more of the background on this than I knew beforehand. And I'll tell you what, when you read that somebody's got a head of campaign finance who's a 25-year-old, that should set off alarm bells. I will tell you from my perspective in finance, almost any time I have seen subterfuge with respect to financing, there is this incredible desire to put in place some patsy in the position of control. And the minute you see somebody of that lack of experience and age in a position like that, you need to take three steps back and wonder why it is that that's the best person they could find for the job. The other thing I'll say here is it's too bad.
Do you know this person? Do you know that he or she is not qualified?
Yes. A 25-year-old
is
not qualified.
Do you know the qualifications?
No,
of
I don't know them. But I will tell you this. A 25-year-old is not qualified to be the head of a campaign finance organization that traffics or that is responsible for millions of dollars of contribution. Full stop. The reason why
a friend of mine, a person I know, is 27 years old, and he was a treasurer of the state of Michigan. So, I mean, it just depends on the skill of the person. Yeah, I don't know anything about this person. I just worry about denigrating somebody that we don't really know.
Well, but to denigrate them given the acts that they've allegedly been involved in. The issue is, by the way, she would have been 22 a couple years ago when this all started, or even younger. When you have somebody whose past experience is so short, they have no reputation that they feel they have to defend. And when they get put in a morally compromising position, they too often, not always, make bad choices. So I'm not saying that all the wildebeest get eaten by the alligators, but seeing them run across the river, too many of them do too often. I'm just saying from a financial control standpoint, and I've had financial organizations try to tell me, well, don't worry, this 28-year-old can be my CFO. And if I had any other doubts about them, which in that case I did, I took three steps back and our bank packed up our bags. Other banks step in and the guy was found guilty of fraud, as was the CFO, and he went to jail. I've just seen the movie too many times. I'm sure there are capable, ethical 28-year-olds, but there are so few of them. And guess what? If you let them wait a little bit till they're 34, they're even more capable. So that I'm just saying it's a big red flag that I've seen it. But I want to return. It's just disappointing, particularly our paint-by-numbers governor, just can't get on TV and say, look, I understand he's innocent, but there's already been too many casualties around this investigation. I mean, for God's sake, Eric Adams' whole cadre of advisors shows up every other day at T-Mobile for a new phone because the government keeps taking him away. And this isn't a bar fight that he had before he was mayor. This is allegedly affecting not only his ability to be mayor, i.e. the campaign funds, but it's also an act that he allegedly performed while mayor. And if he's innocent, go prove yourself innocent. And then I, as governor, if I make the call, and everybody else will suffer your wrath. But in the meantime, I'm going to take a leadership decision and tell you to sit down and resign, or I'll make you resign.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 27th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. Now, I will be sending it over to Sarah LaDuke and Ray Graff, who will be asking for your help to support our station.
Good morning, everybody. This is Sarah LaDuke.
And this is Ray Graff.
And we are here to remind you that the WAMC lockbox is open, and it is imperative to the survival of WAMC that listeners donate as early and often as they can to shorten the fund drive, to help us reach our fundraising goal, to keep us on the air, to keep us bringing you roundtable panels and all of the other programming that we provide. You can pledge any time online at WAMC.org.
You know, our October fund drive begins on the 14th, and what our goal is, it's to fill that lockbox as much as we can before the beginning of the drive. You can do it right now by going to WAMC.org. It's a secure online pledge, and if you want premiums, they're there. You just got to use the old drop-down menu.
That's right. You can check out any sort of WAMC-branded thing, or older programs are available on CD still. I think that does even exist.
Really?
I think so. WAMC.org is the place to go. You can find all of our stories and coverage from the networks that we subscribe to, that part of this money goes toward getting on the air, and everything that we produce in-house, which, as you know, is a great deal of arts and entertainment programming, informative programming, conversative programming, and news.
And new words, apparently. That's very good. You know, you, Sarah LaDuke, as the producer of The Roundtable, and Joe, who is the host of The Roundtable, have done a pretty great job putting these special roundtable panels together that we have been airing during the weekdays at times over these coming, the past weeks and these coming weeks as well.
Yes, indeed.
And this sort of programming is what we do best, and it's why we are here. And you know that WAMC is supported by you, and we really need you if we're going to continue our work. It's WAMC.org. Make that pledge right now.
WAMC.org is the place to pledge currently. It is the weekend, as you know. It's just about 8 a.m. on Saturday morning. So good morning. We hope you have a great weekend. Why don't you set yourself up for a feeling of contentment and pride by supporting your beloved public radio station first thing this morning, and then heading out to pick apples or peep leaves or the like.
That's a great point. And, you know, if you're a longtime listener, this will soothe your guilt. You have done your thing. And even when the fun drive rolls around on October 14th, you have done your thing, and you can only half listen to some of the mayhem.
WAMC.org to make a secure online pledge. Your donations directly impact WAMC's ability to cover critical stories. And we, everybody here at WAMC, top to bottom, we believe that an informed society is vital for a functioning democracy. And we just need financial support to be able to continue to do that, to provide that.
Our underwriters put in a big chunk of what we need to keep going. And you give the biggest chunk of all. And we need you right now. WAMC.org. This station, we do a lot of work. We ain't making a fortune here, I'll tell you that, but we love what we do, and if you love what you get on that side of the radio, support it, WAMC.org.
There will be more special, in-depth election topic roundtable panels this coming week, as Ray mentioned a few minutes ago. We have some scheduled for this coming week. The full fund drive, scheduled to launch on October 14th. However much we have in the lockbox ahead of that will ensure a shorter drive.
Again, we suggest you don't call with your pledge at this moment. The engineer has a lot to do. It's a kind of a thin house on the weekends. So please make your pledge online, WAMC.org.
We are exceedingly grateful, incredibly grateful for all of the support we've seen thus far. We just do need you all to keep it going, WAMC.org. Ray, I'll see you on Monday.
Okie doke.
This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.